Jonasson frowned. Teleborian was contradicting his own reading of Salander. If there was one thing Jonasson felt sure of about her, it was that she was not manipulative. On the contrary, she was a person who stubbornly kept her distance from those around her and showed no emotion at all. He tried to reconcile the picture that Teleborian was painting with his own image of Salander.
"And you've seen her only for a short period when she has been forced to be passive because of her injuries. I have witnessed her violent outbursts and unreasoning hatred. I have spent years trying to help Lisbeth Salander. That's why I'm here. I propose a cooperation between Sahlgrenska Hospital and St. Stephen's."
"What sort of cooperation are you talking about?"
"You're responsible for her medical condition, and I'm convinced that it's the best care she could receive. But I'm extremely worried about her mental state, and I would like to be included at an early stage. I'm ready to offer all the help I can."
"I see.
So I do need access to her, to do a first-hand evaluation of her condition."
"Unfortunately, I cannot help you."
"I beg your pardon?"
"As I said, she's under arrest. If you want to initiate any psychiatric treatment of her, you'll have to apply to Prosecutor Jervas here in Göteborg. She's the one who makes the decisions on these things. And it would have to be done, I repeat, in cooperation with Salander's lawyer, Annika Giannini. If it's a matter of forensic psychiatric report, then the district court would have to issue you a warrant."
"It was just that sort of bureaucratic procedure I wanted to avoid."
"Understood. But I'm responsible for Salander, and if she's going to be taken to court in the near future, we need to have clear documentation of all the measures we have taken. So we're bound to observe the bureaucratic procedures."
"All right. Then I might as well tell you that I've already received a formal commission from Prosecutor Ekström in Stockholm to do a forensic psychiatric report. It will be needed in connection with the trial."
"Then you can also obtain formal access to visit her through the appropriate channels, without sidestepping regulations."
"But while we're discussing bureaucracy, there is a risk that her condition may continue to deteriorate. I'm only interested in her well-being."
"So am I," Jonasson said. "And between us, I can tell you that I see no sign of mental illness. She has been badly treated and is under a lot of pressure, but I see no evidence whatsoever that she is schizophrenic or suffering from paranoid delusions." When at long last he realized that it was fruitless trying to persuade Jonasson to change his mind, Teleborian got up abruptly and took his leave. Jonasson sat for a while staring at the chair Teleborian had been sitting in. It was not unusual for other doctors to contact him with advice or opinions on treatment, but that usually happened only with patients whose doctors were already managing their treatment. He had never before seen a psychiatrist land like a flying saucer, ignore all the protocols, and more or less demand to be given access to a patient whom he obviously had not been treating for several years. After a while, Jonasson glanced at his watch and saw that it was almost 7. He picked up the phone and called Martina Kallgren, the psychologist at Sahlgrenska who had been made available to trauma patients.
"Hello. I'm assuming you've already left for the day. Am I disturbing you?"
"No problem. I'm at home, but just puttering."
"I'm curious about something. You've spoken to our notorious patient, Lisbeth Salander. Could you give me your impression of her?"
"Well, I visited her 3 times and offered to talk with her every time she declined in a friendly but firm way."
"What's your impression of her?"
"What do you mean?"
"Martina, I know that you're not a psychiatrist, but you're an intelligent and sensible person. What general impression did you get of her nature, her state of mind?"
After a while, Kallgren said,
"I'm not sure how I should answer that question. I saw her 2 times soon after she was admitted, but she was in such wretched shape that I didn't make any real contact with her. Then I visited her about 1 week ago at the request of Helena Endrin."
"Why did Helena ask you to visit her?"
"Salander is starting to recover. She mainly just lies there staring at the ceiling. Dr. Endrin wanted me to look in on her."
"And what happened?"
"I introduced myself. We chatted for a couple of minutes. I asked how she was feeling and whether she felt the need to have someone to talk to. She said that she didn't. I asked if I could help her with anything. She asked me to smuggle in a pack of cigarettes."
"Was she angry or hostile?"
"No, I wouldn't say that. She was calm, but she kept her distance. I considered her request for cigarettes more of a joke than a serious need. I asked if she wanted something to read, whether I could bring her books of any sort. At first she said no, but later she asked if I had any scientific journals that dealt with genetics and brain research.
With what?
Genetics.
Genetics?
Yes. I told her that there were some popular science books on the subject in our library. She wasn't interested in those. She said she'd read books on the subject before, and she named some standard works that I'd never heard of. She was more interested in pure research in the field.
Good grief.
I said that we probably didn't have any more advanced books in the patient library. We have more Philip Marlowe than scientific literature, but that I'd see what I could dig up.
And did you?
I went upstairs and borrowed some copies of Nature magazine and the New England Journal of Medicine. She was pleased and thanked me for taking the trouble.
But those journals contain mostly scholarly papers and pure research.
She reads them with obvious interest.
Unison sat speechless for a moment. And how would you rate her mental state?
Withdrawn. She hasn't discussed anything of a personal nature with me.
Do you have the sense that she's mentally ill? Manic depressive or paranoid?
No, no, not at all. If I thought that, I'd have sounded the alarm. She's strange, no doubt about it, and she has big problems and is under stress. But she's calm and matter-of-fact, and seems to be able to cope with her situation. Why do you ask? Has something happened?
No, nothing's happened. I'm just trying to take stock of her.
Chapter 10. Saturday, May 7th to Thursday, May 12th. Blomqvist put his laptop case on the desk. It contained the findings of Olsen, the stringer in Göteborg. He watched the flow of people on Goethegarten. That was one of the things he liked best about his office. Goethegarten was full of life at all hours of the day and night, and when he sat by the window he never felt isolated, never alone. He was under great pressure. He had kept working on the articles that were to go into the summer issue, but he had finally realized there was so much material that not even an issue devoted entirely to the topic would be sufficient. He had ended up in the same situation as during the Wennerström affair, and he had again decided to publish all the articles as a book. He had enough text already for 150 pages, and he estimated that the final book would run to 320 or 336 pages. The easy part was done. He had written about the murders of Svensson and Johansson, and described how he happened to be the one who came upon the scene. He had dealt with why Salander had become a suspect. He spent a chapter debunking first what the press had written about Salander, then what Prosecutor Ekström had claimed, and thereby indirectly the entire police investigation. After long deliberation, he had toned down his criticism of Boblansky and his team. He did this after studying a video from Ekström's press conference, in which it was clear that Boblansky was uncomfortable in the extreme, and obviously annoyed at Ekström's rapid conclusions. After the introductory drama, he'd gone back in time and described Zalachenko's arrival in Sweden, Salander's childhood, and the events that led to her being locked away in St. Stefan's in Uppsala. He was careful to annihilate both Teleborian and the now-dead Björk. He presented the psychiatric report of 1991, and explained why Salander had become a threat to certain unknown civil servants who had taken it upon themselves to protect the Russian defector. He quoted from the correspondence between Teleborian and Björk. He then described Zalachenko's new identity and his criminal operations. He described his assistant Niedermann, the kidnapping of Miriam Wu and Paolo Roberto's intervention. Finally, he summed up the denouement in Gosseberge, which led to Salander's being shot and buried alive, and explained how a policeman's death was a needless catastrophe because Niedermann had already been captured. Then the story became more sluggish. Blomqvist's problem was that the account still had gaping holes in it. Björk had not acted alone. Behind this chain of events, there had to be a larger group with resources and political influence. Nothing else made sense. But he had eventually come to the conclusion that the unlawful treatment of Salander would not have been sanctioned by the government or the bosses of the security police. Behind this conclusion lay no exaggerated trust in government, but rather his faith in human nature. An operation of that type could never have been kept secret if it were politically motivated. Someone would have called in a favour and gotten someone to talk, and the press would have uncovered the Salander affair several years earlier. He thought of the Zalachenko Club as small and anonymous. He could not identify any one of them, except possibly Mortensen, a policeman with a secret appointment who devoted himself to shadowing the publisher of Millennium. It was now clear
that Salander would definitely go to trial. Ekström had brought a charge of aggravated assault in the case of Maggo Lundin and aggravated assault and attempted murder in the case of Carl Axel Bodin. No trial date had yet been set, but Blomqvist's colleagues had learned that Ekström was planning for July, depending on the state of Salander's health. Blomqvist understood the reasoning. A trial during the peak vacation season would attract less attention than one at any other time of the year. Blomqvist's plan was to have the book printed and ready to distribute on the first day of the trial. He and Malm had thought of a paperback edition, shrink-wrapped and sent out with a special summer issue. Various assignments had been given to Cortez and Erickson, who were to produce articles on the history of the secret police, the IB affair, and the like. He frowned as he stared out the window.
"It's not over. The conspiracy is continuing. It's the only way to explain the tapped phones, the attack on Annika, and the double theft of the Salander report. Perhaps the murder of Zalachenko is a part of it too."
But he had no evidence. Together with Erickson and Malm, he had decided that Millennium would publish Svensson's book about sex trafficking, also to coincide with the trial. It was better to present the package all at once, and besides, there was no reason to delay publication. On the contrary, the book would never be able to attract the same attention at any other time. Erickson and Cortez were Blomqvist's principal assistants for the Salander book. Karim and Malm, against his will, had thus become temporary assistant editors at Millennium, with Nielsen as the only available reporter. One result of this increased workload was that Erickson had had to contract several freelancers to produce articles for future issues. It was expensive, but they had no choice. Blomqvist wrote a note on a yellow post-it, reminding himself to discuss the rights to the book with Svensson's family. Svensson's parents lived in Örebro, and were his sole heirs. Blomqvist did not really need permission to publish the book in Svensson's name, but he wanted to go and see them to get their approval. He had postponed the visit because he had had too much to do, but now it was time to take care of the matter. Then there were 100 other details. Some of them concerned how he should present Salander in the articles. To make the ultimate decision, he needed to have a personal conversation to get her approval to tell the truth, or at least parts of it. And he could not have that conversation because she was under arrest, and no visitors were allowed. In that respect, his sister was no help either. She followed the regulations slavishly and had no intention of acting as Blomqvist's go-between. Nor did Giannini tell him anything about what she and her client discussed, other than the parts that concerned the conspiracy against her. Giannini needed help with those. It was frustrating, but all very correct. Consequently, Blomqvist had no clue whether Salander had revealed that her previous guardian had raped her, or that she had taken revenge by tattooing a shocking message on his stomach. As long as Giannini did not mention the matter, neither could he. But Salander's being isolated presented one other acute problem. She was a computer expert and a hacker, which Blomqvist knew, but Giannini did not. Blomqvist had promised Salander that he would never reveal her secret, and he had kept his promise. But now he had a great need for her skills in that field. Somehow he had to establish contact with her. He sighed as he opened Olsen's folder again. There was a photocopy of a passport application form for one Idris Gidi, born 1950. A man with a moustache, olive skin, and black hair going grey at the temples. He was Kurdish, a refugee from Iraq. Olsen had dug up much more on Gidi than on any other hospital worker. Gidi had apparently aroused media attention for a time and had appeared in several articles. Born in the city of Mosul, in northern Iraq, he graduated as an engineer and had been part of the Great Economic Leap Forward in the 70s. In 1984, he was a teacher at the College of Construction Technology in Mosul. He had not been known as a political activist, but he was a Kurd, and so a potential criminal in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. In 1987, Gidi's father was arrested on suspicion of being a Kurdish militant. No elaboration was forthcoming. He was executed in January 1988. 3 months later, Idris Gidi was seized by the Iraqi secret police, taken to a prison outside Mosul, and tortured there for 11 months to make him confess. What he was expected to confess, Gidi never discovered, so the torture continued. In March 1989, one of Gidi's uncles paid the equivalent of 50,000 Swedish kronor to the local leader of the Ba'ath Party, as compensation for the injury Gidi had caused the Iraqi state. 2 days later he was released into his uncle's custody. He weighed 86 pounds and was unable to walk. Before his release, his left hip was smashed with a sledgehammer to discourage any mischief in the future. He hovered between life and death for several weeks. When, slowly, he began to recover, his uncle took him to a farm well away from Mosul, and there, over the summer, his strength returned and he was eventually able to walk again with crutches. He would never regain full health. The question was, what was he going to do in the future? In August, he learned that his 2 brothers had been arrested. He would never see them again. When his uncle heard that Saddam Hussein's police were looking once more for Gidi, he arranged, for a fee equivalent to 30,000 kroner, to get him across the border into Turkey, and from there, with a false passport, to Europe. İdris Gidi landed at Arlanda Airport in Sweden on October 19, 1989. He did not know a word of Swedish, but he had been told to go to the passport police and immediately to ask for political asylum, which he did in broken English. He was sent to a refugee camp in Upplands Väsby. There he would spend almost 2 years, until the immigration authorities decided that Gidi did not have sufficient grounds for a residency permit. By this time, Gidi had learned Swedish and obtained treatment for his shattered hip. He had 2 operations and could now walk without crutches. During that period, the Sjöbo debate had been conducted in Sweden. Refugee camps had been attacked, and Bert Karlsson had formed the New Democracy Party. The reason why Gidi had appeared so frequently in the press archives was that at the 11th hour he got a new lawyer who went directly to the press, and they published reports on his case. Other Kurds in Sweden got involved, including members of the prominent Baksi family. Protest meetings were held and petitions were sent to Minister of Immigration Birgit Friggebo, with the result that Gidi was granted both a residency permit and a work visa in the Kingdom of Sweden. In January 1992 he left Upplands Väsby a free man. Gidi soon discovered that being a well-educated and experienced construction engineer counted for nothing. He worked as a newspaper boy, a dishwasher, a doorman, and a taxi driver. He liked being a taxi driver except for 2 things. He had no local knowledge of the streets in Stockholm County, and he could not sit still for more than an hour before the pain in his hip became unbearable. In May 1998 he moved to Göteborg after a distant relative who owned an office cleaning firm took pity on him. He was given a job on a cleaning crew at Sahlgrenska Hospital, with which the company had a contract. The work was routine. He swabbed floors 6 days a week, including, as Olsen's ferreting had revealed, Corridor 11C. Blomqvist studied the photograph of İdris Gidi from the passport application. Then he logged onto the media archive and picked out several of the articles on which Olsen's report was based. He read attentively. He lit a cigarette. The smoking ban at Millennium had been relaxed soon after Berger left. Cortez now kept an ashtray on his desk. Finally, Blomqvist read what Olsen had produced about Dr. Anders Jonasson. Blomqvist did not see the grey Volvo on Monday, nor did he have the feeling that he was being watched or followed. But he walked briskly from the academic bookshop to the side entrance of NK Department Store, and then straight through and out the main entrance. Anybody who could keep up surveillance inside the bustling NK would have to be superhuman. He turned off both his mobiles and walked through the Galleria to Gustav Adolf's Torg, past the Parliament building and into Gamla Stan. Just in case anyone was still following him, he took a zigzag route through the narrow streets of the old city until he reached the right address and knocked at the door of Black White Publishing. It was 2:30 in the afternoon. He didn't have an appointment, but the editor, Kurdo Baksi, was in and delighted to see him. "Hello there," he said heartily. "Why don't you ever come and visit me any more?" "I'm here to see you right now," Blomqvist said. "Sure, but it's been 3 years since the last time." They shook hands. Blomqvist had known Baksi since the 80s. In fact, Blomqvist had been one of the people who gave Baksi practical help when he started the magazine Black White, with an issue that he produced secretly at night at the Trade Union Confederation offices. Baksi had been caught in the act by Per Erik Åström, the same man who went on to be the paedophile hunter at Save the Children, who in the 80s was the research secretary at the Trade Union Confederation. He had discovered stacks of pages from Black White's first issue, along with an oddly subdued Baksi in one of the copy rooms. Åström had looked at the front page and said, "God almighty, that's not how a magazine is supposed to look."
After that, Ostrom had designed the logo that was on Black White's masthead for 15 years, before Black White magazine went to its grave and became the book publishing house, Black White. At the same time, Blomqvist had been suffering through an appalling period as IT consultant at the Trade Union Confederation, his only venture into the IT field. Ostrom had enlisted him to proofread and give Black White some editorial support. Baxi and Blomqvist had been friends ever since. Blomqvist sat on a sofa while Baxi got coffee from a machine in the hallway. They chatted for a while, the way you do when you haven't seen someone for some time, but they were constantly interrupted by Baxi's mobile. He would have urgent-sounding conversations in Kurdish, or possibly Turkish, or Arabic, or some other language that Blomqvist did not understand. It had always been this way on his other visits to Black White Publishing. People called from all over the world to talk to Baxi.
"My dear Mikhail, you look worried. What's on your mind?"
he said at last. "Could you turn off your phone for a few minutes?" Baxi turned off his phone. "I need a favour, a really important favour, and it has to be done immediately and cannot be mentioned outside this room."
"Tell me."
In 1989, a refugee by the name of Idris Gidi came to Sweden from Iraq. When he was faced with the prospect of deportation, he received help from your family until he was granted a residency permit. I don't know if it was your father or somebody else in the family who helped him.
It was my uncle Mahmoud. I know Gidi. What's going on?
He's working in Göteborg. I need his help to do a simple job. I'm willing to pay him.
What kind of job?
Do you trust me, Kurdo?
Of course. We've always been friends.
The job is very odd. I don't want to say what it entails right now, but I assure you it's in no way illegal, nor will it cause any problems for you or for Gidi. Baxi gave Blomqvist a searching look.
You don't want to tell me what it's about?
The fewer people who know, the better. But I need your help for an introduction so that Idris will listen to me. Baxi went to his desk and opened an address book. He looked through it for a minute before he found the number. Then he picked up the phone. The conversation was in Kurdish. Blomqvist could see from Baxi's expression that he started out with words of greeting and small talk before he got serious and explained why he was calling. After a while, he said to Blomqvist,
"When do you want to meet him?"
"Friday afternoon, if that would work." "Ask if I can visit him at home." Baxi spoke for a short while before he hung up.
"Idris lives in Angered," he said. "Do you have the address?"
Blomqvist nodded.
"He'll be home by 5 on Friday afternoon. You're welcome to visit him there."
"Thanks, Kurdo."
"He works at Sahlgrenska Hospital as a cleaner," Baxi said.
"I know."
"I couldn't help reading in the papers that you're mixed up in this Salander story."
"That's right."
"She was shot?"
"Yes."
"I heard she's at Sahlgrenska."
"That's also true." Baxi knew that Blomqvist was busy planning some sort of mischief, which he was famous for doing. They might not have been best friends, but they never argued either. And Blomqvist had never hesitated if Baxi asked him a favour.
"Am I going to get mixed up in something I ought to know about?"
"You're not going to get involved. Your role was only to do me the kindness of introducing me to one of your acquaintances. And I repeat, I won't ask him to do anything illegal." This assurance was enough for Baxi. Blomqvist stood up. "I owe you one."
"We always owe each other one."
Cortez put down the phone and drummed so loudly with his fingertips on the edge of his desk that Nielsen glared at him. But she could see that he was lost in thought, and since she was feeling irritated in general, she decided not to take it out on him. She knew that Blomqvist was doing a lot of whispering with Cortez and Ericsson and Marm about the Salander story, while she and Karim were expected to do all the grunt work for the next issue of a magazine that hadn't had any real leadership since Berger left. Ericsson was fine, but she lacked the experience and gravitas of Berger, and Cortez was just a young whippersnapper. Nielsen was not unhappy that she had been passed over, nor did she want their jobs. That was the last thing she wanted. Her own job was to keep tabs on the government departments and parliament on behalf of Millennium. She enjoyed the work, and she knew it inside out. Besides, she was overloaded with part-time jobs, like writing a column in a trade journal every week, and various volunteer tasks for Amnesty International and the like. She wasn't interested in being editor-in-chief of Millennium and working a minimum of 12 hours a day, as well as sacrificing her weekends. She did, however, feel that something had changed at Millennium. The magazine suddenly felt foreign,
she could not put her finger on what was wrong. As always, Blomqvist was irresponsible and kept vanishing on another of his mysterious trips, coming and going as he pleased. He was a part owner of Millennium, fair enough. He could decide for himself what he wanted to do, but Jesus, a little sense of responsibility wouldn't hurt. Mom was also part owner, and he was about as much help as he was when he was on vacation. He was talented, no question, and he could step in and take over the reins when Bergo was away or busy, but usually he just followed through with what other people had already decided. He was brilliant at anything involving graphic design or presentations, but he was out of his depth when it came to planning a magazine. Nielsen frowned. No, she was being unfair. What bothered her was that something had happened at the office. Blomqvist was working with Erickson and Cortez, and the rest of them were somehow excluded. Those three had formed an inner circle and were always shutting themselves in Berger's office. Well, Erickson's office. And then they'd all come trooping out in silence. Under Berger's leadership, the magazine had always been a collective. Blomqvist was working on the Salander story and wouldn't share any part of it. This was nothing new. He hadn't said a word about the Venestrom story either. Not even Berger had known. But this time he had two confidants. In a word, Nielsen was pissed off. She needed a vacation. She needed to get away for a while. Then she saw Cortez putting on his corduroy jacket. "I'm going out for a while," he said. "Could you tell Marin that I'll be back in 2 hours?"
"What's going on?"
"I think I've got a lead on a story, a really good story, about toilets. I want to check a few things, but if this pans out, we'll have a fantastic article for the June issue."
"Toilets," Nielsen muttered.
Berger clenched her teeth and put down the article about the forthcoming Salander trial. It was short, 2 columns, intended for page 5, under National News. She looked at the text for a minute and pursed her lips. It was 3:30 on Thursday. She had been working at SMP for exactly 12 days. She picked up the phone and called Holm, the news editor.
"Hello, it's Berger. Could you find Johannes Frisk and bring him to my office ASAP?
She waited patiently until Holm sauntered into the glass cage with a reporter Frisk in tow. Berger looked at her watch.
22, she said.
22 what?
Said Holm.
22 minutes. That's how long it's taken you to get up from the editorial desk, walk the 50 feet to Frisk's desk, and drag yourself over here with him.
You said there was no rush. I was pretty busy.
I did not say there was no rush. I asked you to get Frisk and come to my office. I said ASAP, and I meant ASAP. Not tonight or next week or whenever you feel like getting your butt out of your chair.
But I don't think—
Shut the door.
She waited until Holm had closed the door behind him and studied him in silence. He was without doubt an extremely competent news editor. His role was to make sure that the pages of SMP were filled every day with the correct text, logically organized, and appearing in the order and position they had decided on in the morning meeting. This meant that Holm jangled a colossal number of tasks every day, and he did it without ever dropping a ball. The problem with him was that he consistently ignored the decisions Berger made. She had done her best to find a formula for working with him. She had tried friendly reasoning and direct orders. She had encouraged him to think for himself, and generally she had done everything she could think of to make him understand how she wanted the newspaper to be shaped. Nothing made any difference. An article she had rejected in the afternoon would appear in the newspaper sometime after she had gone home.
"We had a hole we needed to fill, so I had to put in something."
The headline that Berger had decided to use was suddenly replaced by something entirely different. It was not always a bad choice, but it would be done without her consultation, as an act of defiance. It was always a matter of details. An editorial meeting at 2 was suddenly moved to 1:30 without her being told, and most of the decisions were already made by the time she arrived.
"I'm sorry. In the rush, I forgot to let you know."
For the life of her, Berger couldn't see why Holm had adopted this attitude towards her. But she knew that calm discussions and friendly reprimands didn't work. Until now, she hadn't confronted him in front of other colleagues in the newsroom. Now it was time to express herself more clearly, and this time in front of Frisk, which would ensure that the exchange became common knowledge.
"The first thing I did when I started here was to tell you that I had a special interest in everything to do with Lisbeth Salander. I explained that I wanted information in advance on all proposed articles, and that I wanted to look at and approve everything to be published.
I've reminded you about this at least half a dozen times, most recently at the editorial meeting on Friday. Which part of these instructions do you not understand?
All the articles that are planned or in production are on the Daily Memo on our intranet. They're sent to your computer. You're always kept informed, Holmes said.
Bullshit, Berger said. When the City edition of the paper landed in my mailbox this morning, we had a three-column story about Salander and the developments in the Stallerholmen incident in our best news spot.
That was Margareta Oring's article. She's a freelancer. She didn't turn it in until 7 last night.
Margareta called me with a proposal at 11 yesterday morning. You approved it and gave her the assignment at 11:30. You didn't say a word about it at the 2 o'clock meeting.
It's in the Daily Memo.
Oh, right. Here's what it says in the Daily Memo. Quote, Margareta Oring, interview with prosecutor Martina Franson, re narcotics bust in Suratalia, unquote.
The basic story was an interview with Martina Franson about the confiscation of anabolic steroids. A would-be Swarovshire biker was busted for that, Holmes said.
Exactly. And not a word in the Daily Memo about Swarovshire MC, or that the interview would be focused on Maga Lundin and Stallerholmen, and therefore the investigation of Salander.
I assume it came up during the interview.
Anders, I don't know why, but you're standing here lying to my face. I spoke to Margareta, and she said that she clearly explained to you what her interview was going to focus on.
I must not have realised that it would centre on Salander. Then I got an article late in the evening. What was I supposed to do? Kill the whole story? Oring turned in a good piece.
There I agree with you. It's an excellent story, but that's now your third lie in about the same number of minutes. Oring turned it in at 3:20 in the afternoon, long before I went home at 6.
Berger, I don't like your tone of voice.
Great. Then I can tell you that I like neither your tone, nor your evasions, nor your lies.
It sounds as if you think I'm organising some sort of conspiracy against you.
You still haven't answered the question. And item two, today this piece by Johannes shows up on my desk. I can't recall having any discussion about it at the 2 o'clock meeting. Why has one of our reporters spent the day working on Salander without anybody telling me?
Frisk squirmed. He was bright enough to keep his mouth shut.
Holmes said, We're putting out a newspaper, and there must be hundreds of articles you don't know about. We have routines here at SMP, and we all have to adapt to them. I don't have time to give special treatment to specific articles.
I didn't ask you to give special treatment to specific articles. I asked you for two things. First, that I be informed of everything that has a bearing on the Salander case. Second, I want to approve everything we publish on that topic. So, one more time. What part of my instructions did you not understand?
Holmes sighed and adopted an exasperated expression.
Okay, Berger said. I'll make myself crystal clear. I am not going to argue with you about this. Let's see if you understand this message. If it happens again, I'm going to relieve you of your job as news editor. You'll hear bang, boom, and then you'll find yourself editing the family page or the comics, or something like that. I cannot have a news editor whom I can't trust or work with, and who devotes his precious time to undermining my decisions. Understood?
Holmes threw up his hands in a gesture that indicated he considered Berger's accusations to be absurd.
Do you understand me? Yes or no?
I heard what you said.
I asked if you understood. Yes or no?
Do you really think you can get away with this? This paper comes out because I and the other cogs in the machinery work our butts off.
The board is going to do as I say. I'm here to revamp this paper. I have a carefully worded agreement that gives me the right to make far-reaching editorial changes at section editor's level. I can get rid of the dead meat and recruit new blood from outside if I choose. And Holm, you're starting to look like dead meat to me.
She fell silent. Holm met her gaze. He was furious.
That's all, Berger said. I suggest you consider very carefully what we've talked about today.
I don't think...
It's up to you. That's all. Now go.
He turned on his heel and left the glass cage. She watched him disappear into the editorial sea in the direction of the cafeteria. Frisk stood up and made to follow.
Not you, Johannes. You stay here and sit down.
She picked up his article and read it one more time.
You're here on a temporary basis, I gather?
Yes. I've been here 5 months. This is my last week.
How old are you?
27.
I apologize for putting you in the middle of a duel between me and Holm. Tell me about this story.
I got a tip this morning and took it to Holm. He told me to follow up on it.
I see. It's about the police investigating the possibility that Lisbeth Salander was mixed up in the sale of anabolic steroids. Does this story have any connection to yesterday's article about Sir Italia, in which steroids also appeared?
Not that I know of, but it's possible. This thing about steroids has to do with her connection to boxers, Paolo Roberto and his pals.
Paolo Roberto uses steroids?
What? No, of course not. It's more about the boxing world in general. Salander used to train at a gym in Suda. But that's the angle the police are taking, not me. And somewhere the idea seems to have popped up that she might have been involved in selling steroids.
So there's no actual substance to this story at all? Just a rumour?
It's no rumour that the police are looking into the possibility. Whether they're right or wrong, I have no idea yet.
Okay, Johannes. I want you to know that what I'm discussing with you now has nothing to do with my dealings with Holm. I think you're an excellent reporter. You write well, and you have an eye for detail. In short, this is a good story. My problem is that I don't believe it.
I can assure you that it's quite true.
And I have to explain to you why there's a fundamental flaw in the story. Where did the tip come from?
From a source within the police.
Who?
Frisk hesitated. It was an automatic response. Like every other journalist the world over, he was unwilling to name his source. On the other hand, Berger was editor-in-chief and therefore one of the few people who could demand that information from him. An officer named Faster, in the Violent Crimes Division.
Did he call you, or did you call him?
He called me.
Why do you think he called you?
I interviewed him a couple of times during the hunt for Salander. He knows who I am.
And he knows you're 27 and a temp, and that you're useful when he wants to plant information that the prosecutor wants put out.
Sure, I understand all that. But I get a tip from the police investigation and go over and have a coffee with Faster, and he tells me this. He is correctly quoted. What am I supposed to do?
I'm convinced that you quoted him accurately. What should have happened is that you should have taken the information to Holm, who should have knocked on the door of my office and explained the situation. And together we would have decided what to do.
I get it, but I...
You left the material with Holm, who is the news editor. You acted correctly. But let's analyze your article. First of all, why would Faster want to leak this information?
Frisk shrugged.
Does that mean that you don't know or that you don't care?
I don't know.
If I were to tell you that this story is untrue and that Salander doesn't have a thing to do with anabolic steroids, what would you say then?
I can't prove otherwise.
No, indeed. But you think we should publish a story that might be a lie just because we have no proof that it's a lie?
No. We have a journalistic responsibility. But it's a balancing act. We can't refuse to publish when we have a source who makes a specific claim.
We can ask why the source might want this information to get out. Let me explain why I gave orders that everything to do with Salander has to cross my desk. I have special knowledge of the subject that no one else at SMP has. The legal department has been informed that I possess this knowledge but cannot discuss it with them. Millennium is going to publish a story that I am contractually bound not to reveal to SMP, despite the fact that I work here. I obtained the information in my capacity as editor-in-chief of Millennium, and right now I'm caught between two loyalties. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
What I learned at Millennium tells me that I can say without a doubt that this story is a lie, and its purpose is to damage Salander before the trial.
It will be hard to do her any more damage, considering all the revelations that have already come out about her.
Revelations that are largely lies and distortions. Hans Faster is one of the key sources for the claims that Salander is a paranoid and violence-prone lesbian devoted to Satanism and S&M. And the media as a whole bought Faster's propaganda simply because he appears to be a serious source, and it's always cool to write about S&M. Now he's trying a new angle which will put her at a disadvantage in the public consciousness, and which he wants SMP to help disseminate. Sorry, but not on my watch.
I understand.
Do you? Good. Then I can sum up everything I said in one sentence. Your job description as a journalist is to question and scrutinize critically, never to repeat claims uncritically, no matter how highly placed the source is in the bureaucracy. Don't ever forget that. You're a damn good writer, but that talent is completely worthless if you forget your job description.
Right.
I intend to kill this story.
I understand.
This doesn't mean that I distrust you.
Thank you.
So that's why I'm sending you back to your desk with a proposal for a new story.
All right.
The whole thing has to do with my contract with Millennium. I'm not allowed to reveal what I know about the Salander story. At the same time, I'm editor-in-chief of a newspaper that's in danger of skidding because the newsroom doesn't have the information that I have. And we can't allow that to happen. This is a unique situation and applies only to Salander. That's why I've decided to choose a reporter and steer him in the right direction so that we won't end up with our pants down when Millennium comes out.
And you think that Millennium will be publishing something noteworthy about Salander?
I don't think so. I know so. Millennium is sitting on a scoop that will turn the Salander story on its head, and it's driving me crazy that I can't go public with it.
You say you're rejecting my article because you know that it isn't true. That means there's something in the story that all the other reporters have missed.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, but it's difficult to believe that the entire Swedish media has been duped in the same way.
Salander has been the object of a media frenzy. That's when normal rules no longer apply, and any drivel can be printed.
So you're saying that Salander isn't exactly what she seems to be?
Try out the idea that she's innocent of these accusations, that the picture painted of her in the media is nonsense, and that there are forces at work you haven't even dreamed of.
Is that the truth? Berger nodded. So what I just handed in is part of a continuing campaign against her?
Precisely.
Frisk scratched his head. Berger waited until he had finished thinking.
What do you want me to do? Go back to your desk and start working on another story. You don't have to stress out about it, but just before the trial begins, we might be able to publish a whole feature that examines the accuracy of all the statements that have been made about Salander. Start by reading through the clippings, list everything that's been said about her, and check off the allegations one by one.
All right.
Think like a reporter. Investigate who's spreading the story, why it's being spread, and ask yourself whose interests it might serve.
But I probably won't be at SMP when the trial starts. This is my last week. Berger took a plastic folder from a desk drawer and laid a sheet of paper in front of him.
I've extended your assignment by 3 months. You'll finish off this week with your ordinary duties and report in here on Monday.
Thank you.
If you want to keep working at SMP, that is.
Of course I do.
You're contracted to do investigative work outside the normal editorial job. You'll report directly to me. You're going to be a special correspondent assigned to the Salander trial.
The news editor is going to have something to say.
Don't worry about home. I've talked with the head of the legal department and fixed it so there won't be any hassle there. But you're going to be digging into the background, not news reporting. Does that sound good?
It sounds fantastic.
All right, then. That's all. I'll see you on Monday.
As she waved him out of the glass cage, she saw Holm watching her from the other side of the news desk. He lowered his gaze and pretended that he had not been looking at her. Chapter 11. Friday, May 13th to Saturday, May 14th. Blomqvist made sure that he was not being watched when he walked from the Millennium offices early on Friday morning to Salander's old apartment block on Lundegarten. He had to meet Idris Gidi in Göteborg. The question was how to travel there without being observed or leaving a trail. He decided against the train since he didn't want to use a credit card. Normally he would borrow Berger's car, but that was no longer possible. He had thought about asking Cortez or someone else to rent a car for him, but that too would leave a trace. Finally he came up with the obvious solution. He had the keys to Salander's burgundy Honda. It had been parked outside her building since March. He adjusted the seat and saw that the gas tank was half full. Then he backed out and headed across Liljeholmsbrunn towards the E4. At 2:50 he parked on a side street off Avenyn Göteborg. He had a late lunch at the first café he saw. At 4:10 he took the tram to Angered and got off in the centre of town. It took 20 minutes to find Idris Gidi's address. He was about 10 minutes late for their meeting. Gidi opened the door, shook hands with Blomqvist, and invited him into a living room with Spartan furnishings. He had a limp.
He asked Blomqvist to take a seat at the table next to a dresser on which were a dozen framed photographs, which Blomqvist studied.
"My family," Gidi said.
He spoke with a thick accent. Blomqvist suspected that he would not pass the language test recommended by the People's Party of Sweden.
"Are those your brothers?" "My two brothers on the left were murdered by Saddam in the 80s. That's my father in the middle. My two uncles were murdered by Saddam in the 90s. My mother died in 2000. My three sisters are still alive. Two are in Syria, and my little sister is in Madrid."
Gidi poured Turkish coffee.
"Kurdo Baksi sends his greetings."
"Kurdo said you wanted to hire me for a job, but not what it was. I have to tell you right away that I won't take the job if it's illegal. I can't afford to get mixed up in anything like that."
"There is nothing illegal in what I'm going to ask you to do, but it is unusual. The job itself will last for a couple of weeks. It must be done each day, but it'll take only a minute of your time. For this I'm willing to pay you 1,000 kroner a week, which I won't report to the tax authorities."
"I understand. What is it I have to do?"
"One of your jobs at Sahlgrenska Hospital, 6 days a week, if I understand correctly, is to clean Corridor 11C, the intensive care unit."
Gidi nodded. Blomqvist leaned forward and explained his plan. Prosecutor Ekström took stock of his visitor. It was the third time he had met Superintendent Nyström. He saw a lined face framed by short grey hair. Nyström had first come to see him in the days following the murder of Carl Axel Bodin. He had offered credentials to indicate that he worked for SIS. They had had a long, subdued conversation.
"It's important that you understand this. In no way am I trying to influence how you might act or how you do your job. I would also emphasize that under no circumstances can you make public the information I give you," Nyström said.
"I understand."
Truth be told, Ekström did not entirely understand, but he didn't want to look like an idiot by asking questions. He understood that the death of Bodin Zalachenko was a case that had to be handled with the utmost discretion. He also understood that Nyström's visit was off the record, although endorsed by the highest authorities within the security police.
"This is a matter of life or death," Nyström had said at their first meeting. "As far as the security police are concerned, everything related to the Zalachenko case is top secret. I can tell you that he is a defector, a former agent of Soviet military intelligence, and a key player in the Russians' offensive against Western Europe in the 70s.
"That's what Blomqvist at Millennium is evidently alleging.
And in this case, Blomqvist is quite correct. He's a journalist who happened to stumble upon one of the most secret operations ever conducted by Swedish defence."
"He's going to publish the information."
"Of course. He represents the media with all the advantages and drawbacks. We live in a democracy, and naturally we cannot influence what is written in the press. The problem in this case is that Blomqvist knows only a fraction of the truth about Zalachenko, and much of what he thinks he knows is wrong."
"I see."
"What Blomqvist doesn't grasp is that if the truth about Zalachenko comes out, the Russians will swiftly identify our informants and sources in Russia. People who risked their lives for democracy will be in danger of being killed."
"But isn't Russia a democracy now, too? I mean, if this had been during the communist days..."
"That's an illusion. This is about people who spied formally within the Soviet Union. No regime in the world would stand for that, even if it happened many years ago, and a number of these sources are still alive."
No such agents existed, but Ekström couldn't know that. He was bound to take Nyström at his word. And he couldn't help feeling flattered that he was being given information, off the record of course, that was among the most secret to be found in Sweden. He was slightly surprised that the Swedish security police had been able to penetrate the Russian military to the degree Nyström was describing, but he perfectly understood that this was information that absolutely could not be disseminated.
"When I was assigned to make contact with you, we did an extensive investigation of your background," Nyström said.
for seduction always involved discovering someone's weaknesses. Prosecutor Ekstrom's weakness was his belief in his own importance. Like everyone else, he appreciated flattery. The trick was to make him feel that he had been specially chosen.
"We have confirmed that you are a man who enjoys enormous respect within the police force, and, of course, in government circles."
Ekstrom looked pleased. That unnamed individuals in government circles had great confidence in him implied that he could count on their gratitude if he played his cards right.
"Simply stated, my assignment is to provide you with background as necessary and as discreetly as possible. You must understand how improbably complicated this story has become. For one thing, a preliminary investigation is underway for which you bear the primary responsibility. No one, not in the government, or the security police, or anywhere else, can interfere in how you run this investigation. Your job is to ascertain the truth and bring the guilty parties to court. One of the most crucial functions in a democratic state."
Ekstrom nodded.
"It would be a national catastrophe if the whole truth about Zarachenko were to leak out."
"So what exactly is the purpose of your visit?"
"First, to make you aware of the sensitive nature of the situation. I don't think Sweden has been in such an exposed position since the end of the Second World War. One might say that, to a certain extent, the fate of Sweden rests in your hands."
"Who is your superior?"
"I'm sorry, but I cannot reveal the name of anyone working on this case. Let me just say that my instructions come from the very highest levels."
"Good Lord. He's acting on orders from the government, but he can't say without unleashing a political firestorm." Nyström saw that Ekstrom had swallowed the bait.
"What I am able to do, however, is provide you with information. I have been given the authority to use my own judgment in giving you material that is among the most highly classified in this country."
"I see."
"This means that if you have questions about something, whatever it may be, you should turn to me. You must not talk to anyone else in the security police, only to me. My assignment is to be your guide in this labyrinth, and if clashes between various interests threaten to arise, then we will assist each other in finding solutions."
"I understand. In that case, I should say how grateful I am that you and your colleagues are willing to facilitate matters for me."
"We want the legal process to take its course, even though this is a difficult situation."
"Good. I assure you that I will exercise the utmost discretion. This isn't the first time I've handled top-secret information, after all."
"No, we are quite aware of that."
Ekstrom had a dozen questions that Nyström meticulously noted and then answered as best he could. On this third visit, Ekstrom would be given answers to several of the questions he had asked earlier. Among them, and most crucially, what was the truth surrounding Björk's report from 1991?
"That is a serious matter." Nyström adopted a concerned expression. "Since this report surfaced, we have had an analysis group working almost around the clock to discover exactly what happened. We are now close to the point where we can draw conclusions, and they are most unpleasant."
"I can well imagine. That report alleges that the security police and the psychiatrist Peter Teleborian cooperated to place Lisbeth Salander in psychiatric care."
"If only that were the case," Nyström said with a slight smile.
"I don't understand."
"If that was all there was to it, the matter would be simple. Then a crime would have been committed and an indictment could be brought. The difficulty is that this report doesn't correspond with other reports that we have in our archives."
Nyström took out a blue folder and opened it.
"What I have here is the report that Gunnar Björk actually wrote in 1991. Here, too, are the original documents from the correspondence between him and Teleborian. The two versions do not agree."
"Please explain."
"The appalling thing is that Björk has hanged himself, presumably because of the threat of revelations about his sexual deviations. Blomqvist's magazine was going to expose him. That drove him to such depths of despair that he took his own life."
"Well?"
"The original report is an account of Lisbeth Salander's attempt to murder her father, Alexander Zarachenko, with a gasoline bomb. The first 30 pages of the report that Blomqvist discovered agree with the original. These pages, frankly, contain nothing remarkable. It's not until page 33 where Bjork draws conclusions and makes recommendations that the discrepancy arises.
What discrepancy?
In the original version, Bjork presents 5 well-argued recommendations. We don't need to hide the fact that they concern playing down the Zalachenko affair in the media and so forth. Bjork proposes that Zalachenko's rehabilitation, he suffered very severe burns, be carried out abroad, and similar things. He also recommends that Salander be offered the best conceivable psychiatric care.
I see.
The problem is that a number of sentences were altered in a very subtle way. On page 34 there is a paragraph in which Bjork appears to suggest that Salander be branded psychotic so that she will not be believed if anyone should start asking questions about Zalachenko.
And this suggestion is not in the original report?
Precisely. Gunnar Bjork's own report never suggested anything of the kind. Aside from anything else, that would have been against the law. He recommended that she be given the care she quite clearly needed. In Blomqvist's copy, this was made out to be a conspiracy.
Could I read the original?
Be my guest. But I have to take the report with me when I go. And before you read it, let me direct your attention to the appendix containing the subsequent correspondence between Bjork and Teleborian. It is almost entirely fabricated. Here it's not a matter of subtle alterations, but of gross falsifications.
Falsifications?
I think that's the only appropriate description. The original shows that Peter Teleborian was assigned by the district court to do a forensic psychiatric examination of Lisbeth Salander. Nothing out of the ordinary there. Salander was 12 years old and had tried to kill her father. It would have been very strange if that shocking event had not resulted in a psychiatric report.
That's true.
If you had been the prosecutor, I assume that you would have insisted on both social and psychiatric investigations.
Of course.
Even then, Teleborian was a well-respected child psychiatrist who had also worked in forensic medicine. He was given the assignment, conducted a normal investigation, and came to the conclusion that the girl was mentally ill. I don't have to use their technical terms.
No, no.
Teleborian wrote this in a report that he sent to Bjork. The report was then given to the district court, which decided that Salander should be cared for at St. Stephen's. Blomqvist's version is missing the entire investigation conducted by Teleborian. In its place is an exchange between Bjork and Teleborian, which has Bjork instructing Teleborian to falsify a mental examination.
And you're saying that it's an invention? A forgery?
No question about it.
But who would be interested in creating such a thing?
Nyström put down the report and frowned.
Now you're getting to the heart of the problem.
And the answer is?
We don't know. That's the question our analytical group is working very hard to answer.
Could it be that Blomqvist made some of it up?
Nyström laughed.
That was one of our first thoughts, too. But we don't think so. We incline to the view that the falsification was done a long time ago, presumably more or less simultaneously with the writing of the original report, and that leads to one or two disagreeable conclusions. Whoever did the falsification was extremely well informed. In addition, whoever did it had access to the very typewriter that Bjork used.
You mean
we don't know where Bjork wrote the report? It could have been at his home, or at his office, or somewhere else altogether. We can imagine 2 alternatives. Either the person who did the falsification was someone in the psychiatric or forensic medicine department, who for some reason wanted to involve Teleborian in a scandal, or the falsification was done for a completely different purpose, by someone inside the security police.
For what possible reason?
This happened in 1991. There could have been a Russian agent inside SIS who had picked up Zalachenko's trail. Right now we're examining a large number of old personnel files.
But if the GRU had found out, it should have leaked years ago.
You're right. But don't forget that this was during the period when the Soviet Union was collapsing and the GRU was dissolved. We have no idea what went wrong. Maybe it was a planned operation that was shelved. The GRU were masters of forgery and disinformation.
But why would Soviet military intelligence want to plant such a forgery?
We don't know that either. But the most obvious purpose would have been to involve the Swedish government in a scandal.
Ekstrom pinched his lip.
So what you're saying is that the medical assessment of Salander is correct?
Oh, yes. Salander is, to put it in colloquial terms, stark raving mad. No doubt about that. The decision to commit her to an institution was absolutely correct.
Toilets? Erickson sounded as if she thought Cortez was pulling her leg.
Toilets? Cortez repeated.
You want to run a story on toilets? In Millennium?
Erickson could not help laughing. She had observed his ill-concealed enthusiasm when he sauntered into the Friday meeting, and she recognized all the signs of a reporter who had a story in the works.
Explain.
It's really quite simple, Cortez said. The biggest industry in Sweden by far is construction. It's an industry that in practice cannot be outsourced overseas, even if Skanska opens an office in London and stuff like that. No matter what, the houses have to be built in Sweden.
But that's nothing new.
No, but what is new is that the construction industry is a couple of light years ahead of all other Swedish industries when it comes to competition and efficiency. If Volvo built cars the same way, the latest model would cost about 1 million kroner, maybe even 2 million. For most of industry, cutting prices is the constant challenge. For the construction industry, it's the opposite. The price per square foot keeps going up. The state subsidizes the cost with taxpayers' money just so that the prices aren't prohibitive.
Is there a story in that?
Wait, it's complicated. Let's say the price curve for hamburgers had been the same since the 70s, so a Big Mac would cost about 150 kroner or more. I don't want to guess what it would cost with fries or a Coke, but my salary at Millennium might not cover it. How many people around this table would go to McDonald's and buy a burger for 150 kroner?
Nobody said a word.
Understandable. But when NCC bangs together some sheet metal cubes for exclusive rental at Gorshaga on Lidingö, they ask 10,000 to 12,000 kroner a month for a 3-cube apartment. How many of you are paying that much?
I couldn't afford it, Nielsen said.
No, of course not. But you already live in a 1-bedroom apartment by Danvikstol, which your father bought for you 20 years ago, and if you were to sell it, you'd probably get 1.5 million for it. But what does a 20-year-old who wants to move out of the family home do? He can't afford to, so he sublets, or sub-sublets, or lives at home with his mother until he retires.
So where do the toilets come into the picture?
Mom said.
I'm getting to that.
The question is, why are apartments so fucking expensive? Because the people commissioning the buildings don't know how to set the price. To put it simply, a developer calls up Skanska, says they want 100 apartments, and asks what it will cost. Skanska calculates it, comes back and says it'll cost around 500 million kroner, which means that the price per square foot will be X kroner, and it will cost 10,000 a month if you want to move in. But unlike the McDonald's example, you don't really have a choice. You have to live somewhere, so you have to pay the going rate.
Henry, dear, please get to the point.
But that is the point. Why should it cost 10,000 a month to live in those crappy dumps in Hammarbyhamnen?
Because the construction companies don't give a damn about keeping prices down.
The customer's going to have to pay come what may. One of the big costs is building materials. The trade in building materials goes through wholesalers who set their own prices. Since there isn't any real competition there, a bathtub retails for 5,000 kroner in Sweden. The same bathtub, from the same manufacturer, retails for the equivalent of 2,000 kroner in Germany. There is no added cost that can satisfactorily explain the price difference.
There was impatient muttering around the table.
You can read about a lot of this in a report from the government's construction cost delegation, which was active in the late 90s. Since then, not much has happened. No one is talking to the construction companies about the unreasonable prices. The buyers cheerfully pay what they are told it costs, and in the end the price burden falls on the renters, or the taxpayers.
Henry, the toilets?
The little that has changed since the construction cost delegation's report has happened at the local level, and primarily outside Stockholm. There are buyers who got fed up with the high construction prices. One example is Karlskrona Homes, which builds houses less expensively than anyone else by buying the materials themselves. And Svensk Handel has also gotten into the game. They think that the price of construction materials is absurd, so they've been trying to make it easier for companies to buy less expensive products that are equally good. And that led to a little clash at the construction fair at Alvsjö last year. Svensk Handel had brought in a man from Thailand,
who was selling toilets for 500 kroner apiece. And what happened? His nearest competitor was a Swedish wholesale outfit called Vidovara Inc., which sells genuine Swedish toilets for 1,700 kroner apiece. And shrewd municipal buyers started to scratch their heads and wonder why they were shelling out 1,700 kroner when they could get a similar toilet from Thailand for 500. "Better quality, maybe?" Karim said. "No, the exact same." "Thailand," Malm said. "That sounds like child labour and stuff like that, which could explain the low price." "Not so," Cortez said. "Child labour exists mostly in the textile and souvenir industries in Thailand, and the paedophile industry, of course. The United Nations keeps an eye on child labour, and I've checked out this company. They're a reputable manufacturer. It's a big, modern, respectable operation, producing appliances and plumbing goods." "All right. But we're talking about low-wage countries, and that means you risk writing an article proposing that Swedish industry should be outbid by Thai industry. Fire the Swedish workers and close the factories here and import everything from Thailand. You won't win any points with the Trade Union Confederation." A smile spread over Cortez's face. He leaned back and looked ridiculously pleased with himself. "No, again," he said. "Guess where Vidovara Inc. makes its toilets to sell at 1,700 kroner apiece." Silence fell over the room. "Vietnam," Cortez said. "You've got to be kidding," Ericsson said. "They've been making toilets there for at least 10 years. Swedish workers were already out of that race in the 90s. "Oh, shit. But here comes my point. If you imported directly from the factory in Vietnam, the price will be in the order of 390 kroner. Guess how you can explain the price difference between Thailand and Vietnam?" "Don't tell me that..." "Oh, yes. Vidovara Inc. subcontracts the work to an outfit called Phong Su Industries. They're on the UN list of companies that use child labour. At least they were in an investigation from 2001, but the majority of the workers are convicts." Ericsson burst out laughing. "This is great. This is really great. I'm sure you're going to be a journalist when you grow up. How fast can you have the story ready?" 2 weeks. I have a lot of international trade stuff to check out, and then we need a bad guy for the story, so I'm going to see who runs Vidovara Inc. Then we could run it in the June issue." "No problem." Inspector Bublansky listened to Prosecutor Ekstrom without expression. The meeting had lasted 40 minutes, and Bublansky was feeling an intense desire to reach out and grab the copy of The Law of the Swedish Kingdom that lay on the edge of Ekstrom's desk and ram it down the prosecutor's throat. He wondered what would happen if he acted on his impulse. There would certainly be headlines in the evening papers, and it would probably result in an assault charge. He pushed the thought away. The whole point of the socialized human being was to not give in to that sort of impulse, regardless of how belligerently an opponent might behave. Of course, it was usually after somebody had given in to such impulses that Inspector Bublansky was called in.
"I take it we're in agreement," Ekstrom said.
"No, we are not in agreement," Bublansky said, getting to his feet. "But you're the leader of the preliminary investigation."
He muttered to himself as he turned down the hall to his office, summoning Anderson and Modig as he went. They were the only colleagues available to him that afternoon, as Holmberg had regrettably opted to take a 2-week vacation.
"My office," Bublansky said. "Bring some coffee."
After they settled in, Bublansky looked at the notes from his meeting with Ekstrom.
"As the situation stands, our preliminary investigation leader has dropped all charges against Lisbeth Salander relating to the murders for which she was being sought. She is no longer part of the preliminary investigation as far as we're concerned."
"That can be considered a step forward at any rate," Modig said. Anderson, as usual, said nothing.
"I'm not so sure about that," Bublansky said. "Salander is still suspected in connection with the events at Stallarholmen and Gossebergia. But we're no longer involved with those investigations. We have to concentrate on finding Niedermann and working on the graves in the woods at Nykvarn. On the other hand, it's now clear that Ekstrom is going to bring charges against Salander. The case has been transferred to Stockholm, and an entirely new investigation has been set up for the purpose."
"Oh, really?" Modig said.
"And who do you think is going to investigate Salander?" Bublansky said.
"I'm fearing the worst."
"Hans Faster is back on duty, and he's going to assist Ekstrom.
That's insane. Fasta is grossly unsuited to investigate anything at all to do with Salander.
I know that, but Ekstrom has a good argument. Fasta has been out on sick leave, and this will be the perfect, simple case for him to focus on.
Silence.
The long and the short of it is that we're to hand over all our material on Salander to him this afternoon.
And this story about Gunnar Björk and Seppo and the 1991 report is going to be handled by Fasta and Ekstrom.
I don't like this, Modig said.
Nor do I. But Ekstrom's the boss, and he has backing from higher up in the bureaucracy. In other words, our job is still to find the killer. Kurt, what's the situation?
Anderson shook his head. Niedermann seems to have been swallowed up by the earth. I have to admit that in all my years on the force, I've never seen anything like it. We haven't had any tip-offs, and we don't have a single informer who knows him or has any idea where he might be.
That sounds fishy, Modig said.
But he's being sought for the police murder in Gossenberger, for aggravated assault on another officer, for the attempted murder of Salander, and for the aggravated kidnapping and assault of the dental hygienist Anita Kaspersen, as well as for the murders of Svensson and Johansson. In every instance there's good forensic evidence.
That helps a bit, at least. How's it going with the case of Svavelshire MC's treasurer?
Victor Goransson and his girlfriend, Lena Nygren. We have forensic evidence that ties Niedermann to the scene. Fingerprints and DNA from Goransson's body. Niedermann must have bloodied his knuckles pretty badly during the beating.
Anything new on Svavelshire MC?
Niemann has taken over as club president while Lundin remains in custody, awaiting trial for the kidnapping of Miriam Wu. There's a whisper that Niemann has offered a big reward to anyone who can provide information on Niedermann's whereabouts.
If the entire underworld is looking for him, it's even stranger that he hasn't been found. What about Goransson's car?
Since we found Kaspersen's car at Goransson's place, we're sure that Niedermann switched vehicles, but we have no trace of the car he took.
So we have to ask ourselves, 1, is Niedermann still hiding out somewhere in Sweden? 2, if so, with whom? 3, is he out of the country? What do we think?
We have nothing to indicate that he's left the country, but really that seems his most logical course.
Where did he ditch the car?
Modig and Anderson shook their heads.
9 times out of 10, police work was uncomplicated when it came to looking for one specific individual. It was about initiating a logical sequence of inquiries. Who were his friends? Who had he been in prison with? Where did his girlfriend live? Who did he drink with? In what area was his mobile last used? Where was his vehicle? At the end of that sequence, the fugitive would generally be found. The problem with Niedermann was that he had no friends, no girlfriend, and no listed mobile. And he had never been in prison. The inquiries had concentrated on finding Goransson's car, which Niedermann was presumed to be using. They had expected the car to turn up in a matter of days, probably in some parking lot in Stockholm, but there was still no sign of it.
If he's out of the country, where would he be?
He is a German citizen, so the obvious thing would be for him to head for Germany.
He seems not to have had any contact with his old friends in Hamburg.
Anderson waved his hand.
If his plan was to go to Germany, why would he drive to Stockholm?
Shouldn't he have made for Malmö, on the bridge to Copenhagen, or for one of the ferries?
I know.
And Inspector Elander in Göteborg has been focusing his search in that direction from day one. The Danish police have been informed about Goransson's car, and we know for sure that he didn't take any of the ferries.
But he did drive to Stockholm and to Svavelshire, and there he murdered the club's treasurer, and, we can assume, made off with an unspecified sum of money.
What would his next step be? He has to get out of Sweden, Boblanski said. The most direct option would be to take one of the ferries across the Baltic. Goransson and his girlfriend were murdered late on the night of April 9th. Niedermann could have taken the ferry the next morning. We got the alarm roughly 16 hours after they died, and we've had an APB out on the car ever since.
If he took the morning ferry, then Goransson's car would be parked at one of the ports, Modig said.
Perhaps we haven't found the car because Niedermann drove out of the country to the north via Haparanda. It's a big detour around the Gulf of Bothnia, but in 16 hours he could have been in Finland.
Sure, but soon after he would have had to abandon the car in Finland, and it should have been found by now.
They sat in silence.
Finally, Boblansky got up and stood at the window.
Couldn't he have found a hiding place where he's just lying low? A summer cabin, or...
I don't think it would be a summer cabin. This time of year, every cabin owner is out checking their property. And he wouldn't try anywhere connected to Svarvershire MC. They're the last people he'd want to run into.
The entire underworld can be ruled out as well. Any girlfriend we don't know about?
They could speculate, but they had no facts.